Chapter 37. Sign, a piece of bright red cloth, to the hotel where this meal is prepared. There being many boarders here, we sit down, a large party, and a very melancholy one as usual. But there is a buxom hostess at the head of the table, and opposite, a simple Welsh schoolmaster with his wife and child, who came here, on a speculation of greater promise than performance, to teach the classics. And they are sufficient subjects of interest until the meal is over, and another coach is ready. In it we go on once more, lighted by a bright moon, until midnight, when we stop to change the coach again, and remain for half an hour or so in a miserable room, with a blurred lithograph of Washington over the smoky fireplace, and a mighty jug of cold water on the table, to which refreshment the moody passengers do so apply themselves, that they would seem to be, one and all, keen patients of Dr. Sangrado. Among them is a very little boy, who chews tobacco like a very big one, and a droning gentleman, who talks arithmetically and statistically on all subjects, from poetry downwards, and who always speaks in the same key, with exactly the same emphasis, and with very grave deliberation. He came outside just now, and told me how, that the uncle of a certain young lady who had been spirited away, and married by a certain captain, lived in these parts, and how this uncle was so valiant, and ferocious that he shouldn't wonder, if he were to follow the said captain to England, and shoot him down in the street wherever he found him. Apostrophe in the feasibility of which strong measure I, being for the moment rather prone to contradiction, from feeling half asleep and very tired, declined to acquiesce, assuring him that, if the uncle did resort to it, or gratified any other little whim of the like nature, he would find himself one morning prematurely throttled at the Old Bailey, and that he would do well, to make his will before he went, as he would certainly want it, before he had been in Britain very long. On we go, all night, and by the day begins to break, and presently the first cheerful rays of the warm sun come slanting on us brightly. It sheds its light upon a miserable waste of sodden grass, and dull trees, and squalid huts, whose aspect is forlorn, and grievous in the last degree. A very desert in the wood, whose growth of green is dank, and noxious like that upon the top of standing water, where poisonous fungus grows in the rare footprint on the oozy ground, and sprouts like witch's coral, from the crevices, in the cabin wall and floor. It is a hideous thing, to lie upon the very threshold of a city. But it was purchased years ago, and as the owner cannot be discovered, the state has been unable to reclaim it. So there it remains, in the midst of cultivation and improvement, like ground accursed, and made obscene and rank by some great crime. We reached Columbus shortly before 7 o'clock, and stayed there, to refresh, that day and night, having excellent apartments in a very large unfinished hotel called the Neal House, which were richly fitted with the polished wood of the black walnut, and opened on a handsome portico and stone veranda, like rooms in some Italian mansion. The town is clean and pretty, and of course is going to be much larger. It is the seat of the state legislature of Ohio, and lays claim, in consequence, to some consideration and importance. There being no stagecoach next day, upon the road we wished to take, I hired an extra, apostrophe at a reasonable charge, to carry us to Tiffin, a small town from whence there is a railroad to Sandusky. This extra was an ordinary four-horse stagecoach, such as I have described, changing horses and drivers, as the stagecoach would, but was exclusively our own for the journey. To ensure our having horses at the proper stations, and being incommoded by no strangers, the proprietors sent an agent on the box, who was to accompany us the whole way through, and thus attended, and bearing with us, besides, a hamper full of savory cold meats, and fruit, and wine, we started off again in high spirits, at 6:30 next morning, very much delighted to be by ourselves, and disposed to enjoy even the roughest journey. It was well for us that we were in this humor, for the road we went over that day was certainly enough to have shaken tempers that were not resolutely at set fair, down to some inches below Stormy. At one time we were all flung together in a heap at the bottom of the coach, and at another we were crushing our heads against the roof. Now, one side was down deep in the mire, and we were holding on to the other. Now, the coach was lying on the tails of the two-wheelers. And now it was rearing up in the air, in a frantic state, with all four horses standing on the top of an insurmountable eminence, looking coolly back at it, as though they would say, "Unharness us. It can't be done." Apostrophe the drivers on these roads, who certainly get over the ground in a manner which is quite miraculous, so twist and turn the team about in forcing a passage, corkscrew fashion, through the bogs and swamps, that it was quite a common circumstance on looking out of the window, to see the coachman with the ends of a pair of reins in his hands, apparently driving nothing, or playing at horses, and the leaders staring at one unexpectedly from the back of the coach, as if they had some idea of getting up behind. A great portion of the way was over what is called a corduroy road, which is made by throwing trunks of trees into a marsh, and leaving them to settle there. The very slightest of the jolts with which the ponderous carriage fell from log to log, was enough, it seemed, to have dislocated all the bones in the human body. It would be impossible to experience a similar set of sensations, in any other circumstances, unless perhaps in attempting to go up to the top of St. Paul's in an omnibus. Never, never once, that day, was the coach in any position, attitude, or kind of motion to which we are accustomed in coaches. Never did it make the smallest approach to one's experience of the proceedings of any sort of vehicle that goes on wheels. Still, it was a fine day, and the temperature was delicious, and though we had left summer behind us in the west, and were fast leaving spring, we were moving towards Niagara and home. We alighted in a pleasant wood towards the middle of the day, dined on a fallen tree, and leaving our best fragments with a cottager, and our worst with the pigs who swarm in this part of the country like grains of sand on the seashore, to the great comfort of our commissariat in Canada, we went forward again, gaily. As night came on, the track grew narrower and narrower, until at last it so lost itself among the trees, that the driver seemed to find his way by instinct. We had the comfort of knowing, at least, that there was no danger of his falling asleep, for every now and then a wheel would strike against an unseen stump with such a jerk, that he was fain to hold on pretty tight and pretty quick, to keep himself upon the box. Nor was there any reason to dread the least danger from furious driving, inasmuch as over that broken ground the horses had enough to do to walk. As to shying, there was no room for that, and a herd of wild elephants could not have run away in such a wood, with such a coach at their heels. So we stumbled along, quite satisfied. These stumps of trees are a curious feature in American traveling. The varying illusions they present to the unaccustomed eye as it grows dark are quite astonishing in their number and reality. Now, there is a Grecian urn erected in the center of a lonely field. Now there is a woman weeping at a tomb. Now a very commonplace old gentleman in a white waistcoat, with a thumb thrust into each armhole of his coat. Now a student poring on a book. Now a crouching negro. Now, a horse, a dog, a cannon, an armed man, a hunchback throwing off his cloak, and stepping forth into the light. They were often as entertaining to me as so many glasses in a magic lantern, and never took their shapes at my bidding, but seemed to force themselves upon me, whether I would or no, and strange to say, I sometimes recognized in them counterparts of figures once familiar to me in pictures attached to childish books, forgotten long ago. It soon became too dark, however, even for this amusement, and the trees were so close together that their dry branches rattled against the coach on either side, and obliged us all to keep our heads within. It lightened too, for 3 whole hours, each flash being very bright, and blue, and long, And as the vivid streaks came darting in among the crowded branches, and the thunder rolled gloomily above the treetops, one could scarcely help thinking that there were better neighborhoods at such a time than thick woods afforded. At length, between 10 and 11 o'clock at night, a few feeble lights appeared in the distance, and Upper Sandusky, an Indian village, where we were to stay till morning, lay before us. They were gone to bed at the Log Inn, which was the only house of entertainment in the place, but soon answered to our knocking, and got some tea for us in a sort of kitchen or common room, tapestried with old newspapers, pasted against the wall. The bedchamber to which my wife and I were shown was a large, low, ghostly room, with a quantity of withered branches on the hearth, and two doors without any fastening, opposite to each other, both opening on the black night and wild country, and so contrived that one of them always blew the other open. A novelty in domestic architecture, which I do not remember to have seen before, and which I was somewhat disconcerted to have forced on my attention, after getting into bed, as I had a considerable sum in gold for our traveling expenses, in my dressing case. Some of the luggage, however, piled against the panels, soon settled this difficulty, and my sleep would not have been very much affected that night, I believe, though it had failed to do so. My Boston friend climbed up to bed, somewhere in the roof, where another guest was already snoring hugely. But being bitten beyond his power of endurance, he turned out again, and fled for shelter to the coach, which was airing itself in front of the house. This was not a very politic step, as it turned out, for the pig scenting him, and looking upon the coach as a kind of pie with some manner of meat inside, grunted round it so hideously, that he was afraid to come out again, and lay there shivering, till morning. Nor was it possible to warm him, when he did come out, by means of a glass of brandy. For in Indian villages, the legislature, with a very good and wise intention, forbids the sale of spirits by tavern keepers. The precaution, however, is quite inefficacious, for the Indians never fail to procure liquor of a worse kind, at a dearer price, from traveling peddlers. It is a settlement of the Wyandot Indians who inhabit this place. Among the company at breakfast was a mild old gentleman, who had been for many years employed by the United States government in conducting negotiations with the Indians, and who had just concluded a treaty with these people by which they bound themselves, in consideration of a certain annual sum, to remove next year to some land provided for them, west of the Mississippi, and a little way beyond St. Louis. He gave me a moving account of their strong attachment to the familiar scenes of their infancy, and in particular to the burial places of their kindred, and of their great reluctance to leave them. He had witnessed many such removals, and always with pain, though he knew that they departed for their own good. The question whether this tribe should go or stay had been discussed among them a day or two before, in a hut erected for the purpose, the logs of which still lay upon the ground before the inn. When the speaking was done, the yeas and noes were ranged on opposite sides, and every male adult voted in his turn. The moment the result was known, the minority, a large one, cheerfully yielded to the rest, and withdrew all kind of opposition. We met some of these poor Indians afterwards, riding on shaggy ponies. They were so like the meaner sort of gypsies, that if I could have seen any of them in England, I should have concluded, as a matter of course, that they belonged to that wandering and restless people. Leaving this town directly after breakfast, we pushed forward again, over a rather worse road than yesterday, if possible, and arrived about noon at Tiffin, where we parted with the extra. At 2 o'clock we took the railroad, the traveling on which was very slow, its construction being indifferent, and the ground wet and marshy, and arrived at Sandusky in time to dine that evening. We put up at a comfortable little hotel on the brink of Lake Erie, lay there that night, and had no choice but to wait there next day, until a steamboat bound for Buffalo appeared. The town, which was sluggish and uninteresting enough, was something like the back of an English watering place, out of the season. Our host, who was very attentive, and anxious to make us comfortable, was a handsome middle-aged man, who had come to this town from New England, in which part of the country he was raised. Apostrophe when I say, that he constantly walked in, and out of the room with his hat on, and stopped to converse in the same free and easy state, and lay down on our sofa, and pulled his newspaper out of his pocket, and read it at his ease. I merely mention these traits as characteristic of the country, not at all as being matter of complaint, or as having been disagreeable to me. I should undoubtedly be offended by such proceedings at home, because there they are not the custom, and where they are not, they would be impertinencies. But in America, the only desire of a good-natured fellow of this kind, is to treat his guests hospitably and well, and I had no more right, and I can truly say no more disposition, to measure his conduct by our English rule and standard, than I had to quarrel with him for not being of the exact stature which would qualify him for admission into the Queen's Grenadier Guards. As little inclination had I to find fault with a funny old lady who was an upper domestic in this establishment, and who, when she came to wait upon us at any meal, sat herself down comfortably in the most convenient chair, and producing a large pin, to pick her teeth with, remained performing that ceremony, and steadfastly regarding us meanwhile with much gravity and composure now, and then pressing us to eat a little more, until it was time to clear away. It was enough for us, that whatever we wished, done was done with great civility and readiness, and a desire to oblige, not only here, but everywhere else, and that all our wants were, in general, zealously anticipated. We were taking an early dinner at this house, on the day after our arrival, which was Sunday, when a steamboat came in sight, and presently touched at the wharf. As she proved to be on her way to Buffalo, we hurried on board with all speed, and soon left Sandusky far behind us. She was a large vessel of 500 tons, and handsomely fitted up, though with high-pressure engines, which always conveyed that kind of feeling to me, which I should be likely to experience, I think, if I had lodgings on the first floor of a powder mill. She was laden with flour, some casks of which commodity were stored upon the deck. The captain coming up to have a little conversation, and to introduce a friend, seated himself astride of one of these barrels, like a Bacchus of private life, and pulling a great clasp knife out of his pocket, began to whittle it as he talked, by paring thin slices off the edges. And he whittled with such industry and hearty goodwill, that but for his being called away very soon, it must have disappeared bodily, and left nothing in its place, but grist and shavings. After calling at one or two flat places, with low dams stretching out into the lake, whereon were stumpy lighthouses, like windmills without sails, the whole looking like a Dutch vignette, we came at midnight to Cleveland, where we lay all night, and until 9 o'clock next morning. I entertained quite a curiosity in reference to this place, from having seen at Sandusky a specimen of its literature in the shape of a newspaper, which was very strong indeed upon the subject of Lord Ashburton's recent arrival at Washington, to adjust the points in dispute between the United States government and Great Britain, informing its readers that as America had whipped England in her infancy, and whipped her again in her youth, so it was clearly necessary that she must whip her once again in her maturity, and pledging its credit to all true Americans, that if Mr. Webster did his duty in the approaching negotiations, and sent the English lord home again in double quick time, they should, within 2 years, sing Yankee Doodle in Hyde Park, and hail Columbia in the scarlet courts of Westminster. I found it a pretty town, and had the satisfaction of beholding the outside of the office of the journal from which I have just quoted. I did not enjoy the delight of seeing the wit who ended it the paragraph in question, but I have no doubt he is a prodigious man in his way, and held in high repute by a select circle. There was a gentleman on board, to whom, as I unintentionally learned through the thin partition which divided our stateroom. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.